All right. So you're probably wondering, what did that have to do with HTML5? It has nothing to do with HTML5. I just like the music, so I wanted to start off with it. How about that? Hey, it's the last session of the day, last session of the week, as a matter of fact, so what are they going to do, kick me out? So, yeah, a little jet video there. If you've never seen those before, those are radio-controlled jets. That's my hobby. I build those things. Takes me about 2 years, generally, to build one. That's the second to last one that I built. I just finished, back in December, building a 1/6 scale model of a Swiss F5, which, to me, has always been a beautiful jet and a beautiful paint scheme. Unfortunately, I don't have any videos of it yet. I've put it through its initial round of test flights, but it's still waiting another round. Maybe if I'm back here next year, I'll show some video of that plane. But what a way to start the session, huh? Doesn't that get your blood pumping? It does mine. Maybe I'll just play it again. Yeah, maybe not. So how about some HTML5? I assume that's what you're here for. Put together a little talk here that I wanted to share with you. But before I do that, I want to give you a URL. I'm going to show you lots and lots and lots of code. In fact, this session is almost all code. And if you would like a copy of all these code samples I'll be showing, plus a lot that I won't show, by the way, you can go to this URL at your convenience, download a zip file containing a Visual Studio solution with everything that I show you and more. Remember, since it's a SkyDrive URL, those last six characters are case sensitive. And I'll put this back up at the end of the session in case someone comes in late or you didn't get a chance to write it down or something like that. Again, this is where you can go to get the samples that I'm going to show you. So this session is entitled, just to make sure you're in the right place, it is entitled HTML5, the good, the bad, and everything in between. It's kind of interesting what's happening in our industry, isn't it? For years and years and years, I was a native guy, you know, writing C++ and C# and all that. And I still am. I still enjoy writing native code. But you know what? About half of my time these days is spent writing HTML5 code. Number one, because a lot of our customers are asking for that. That's the avenue that they want us to take. Another reason I'm heavily involved with HTML5 today is that, like many, many developers around the world, I am challenged by how do I write an application that runs on all of these different mobile devices without writing it three separate times for iOS, for Windows Phone, for Android, perhaps for other platforms. That, I think, is the biggest reason that we're being driven towards HTML5, but it's not the only reason. So I thought it might be interesting at this conference to sort of assess the state of HTML5 and to do it in a way that is code-heavy so that those of you who might not have spent a lot of time with HTML5 but wandered into this session wondering, what is it? What's all the hype and the buzz about? That it might give you some idea of what HTML5 is and what it is not. And I decided to say the good, the bad, and everything in between because guess what, folks? HTML5 is not perfect. It will not do everything that native platforms will do. The things that it does do, it tends to do very well. It does it in a lot of different places, especially in browsers on mobile devices, helping us build cross-platform apps. But developers who get into HTML5 are often disappointed by the things that it doesn't do. Now, HTML5 is something that is constantly evolving. There are specifications for features that are underway right now that aren't yet implemented by any browser vendor. So if I come back and do the same talk again a year from now, it will probably be quite different than it is today. Today, we're going to look at the features that are there, that are ready for use, at least in some shape, form, or fashion. And I'm going to give each of the features a grade and describe to you why I gave it that grade. And I want to start with a relatively recent addition to the HTML5 family, which is an API called the History API. Simply put, browsers for years have given us browser-specific ways to access the browser's backstack through code. But there's never been a standard and agreed-upon way to do it until now with HTML5's new History API. What does this allow us to do? It allows us to programmatically add nodes to the browser's history stack, the same nodes that get added when the user navigates from one page to another. And it allows us to know when the back button has been pressed so that we can revert a page to a previous state, to the state it was in when we pushed that node onto the history stack. Now, you may hear that and wonder, but why would I ever need that? Is there a practical use for it? Well, it turns out there is. And I'm going to show you a very practical use for it. The grade that I give this feature is A-. That's about as high a grade as you can get. The only thing that would make it better is if this API were a little bit richer and allowed me to manipulate the back stack in more ways than it does today. But in terms of solving a very common problem that web developers encounter and solving it in a reasonably clean way, this feature fits the bill very, very well. To demonstrate that, I'd like to go into Visual Studio and run the first of these demos that's in that demo set. Let's close down Outlook, no telling what it's going to do. There went 60 threads right there. Let's open up this project, the solution rather. It's the one in the zip file whose URL I gave you. And it's called HTML5 Demos. So I want to start by running a page for you. It's an HTML5 page with some interaction built into it. It's here in my history folder. And it's the home page for a fictitious newspaper-style site called the Contoso Times. If you click around here in the left nav bar, I'm using Ajax through jQuery to load fresh content from a web service, and I'm showing that content to the user. This is a canonical single-page application. It may look to the user as if we're navigating from page to page, but in order to keep these refreshes clean, I'm not navigating from page to page. I'm doing all this in one page and fetching fresh content with Ajax on each click. But there's a problem with that. Some of you have already spotted it. You'll notice that as I click around, nothing changes in the browser's address bar. Meaning, because I chose to make this a single-page app and load content via Ajax, the user cannot use the back button to step backwards through the various articles that they've viewed. Also, because nothing's changing in the address bar, they can't deep link an article. They can't find an article they find interesting, email the link to a friend. This is one of the most common complaints that users give us about Ajax and about single-page apps in general, and it is a problem that the History API in HTML5 fixes and fixes very well. Let me demonstrate that for you with this page, which is another version of the same page, but this time one that uses the History API. Looks the same on the outside. I click around here, and I want you to notice as I click, the URL in the browser's address bar is changing, meaning there is deep linkability in this app. Furthermore, the browser's back button lit up. And now, even though it is a single-page app, of course, an average user may have no idea what that is, that user can click that back button to step backward through the articles. So I get to have my cake and eat it too. I get the cleanness and the freshness of a single-page app, not requiring the user to actually navigate from page to page and reload the entire page. But in terms of functionality, it's as if they were navigating from page to page because I have back button support and deep linking support. The secret to doing that was using HTML5's History API. Let me show you what that looks like. For starters, here is the code that wires up click handlers to all those items in the left nav bar. I'm finding those handlers with jQuery. They're stylized HTML anchor elements. I wire a click handler to each. And it's actually right here where I'm using jQuery's load method to go load fresh content from the server with Ajax. But here's where the History API comes in. After I fetch that new content and shown it to the user, I first make sure this browser supports the HTML5 History API by checking for a new property named History on the window object and on that property a method named pushState. And if those are there, then I add a node to the browser's history stack by calling window.history.pushState. Each time you call this, you're basically bookmarking the state of the page so that the user can revert the page to that state by clicking the browser's back button. Now, when you call push state, it accepts three parameters. The first is anything you want it to be. It could be a simple JavaScript object here, like this one here. In fact, I'm just passing in a string. It could be a very complex JavaScript object. It can be anything. The key is here, as you're going to see in a moment, if the user does click the browser's back button, it's your job, not the browser's job, to restore that page to the state it was in when you called push state. So what you pass into push state here is whatever you need to recreate the state of that page. In my case, all I need is a string identifying the article that was fetched from the server. In other apps, you may need more complex data right there. The second parameter is unused in any modern browser. It's technically called the title parameter. The third one is the URL that I want to appear in the browser's address bar. So this is one half of the equation, one half of the history API, where as the user interacts with our page, we simulate them moving from page to page by adding nodes to the browser's history stack. That and that alone causes the browser's back button to be lit up. But that is only half of the equation. The other half is this. In a browser that supports this new history API, the window object fires pop state events. These events fire when the user clicks the browser's back button. When the back button is clicked, the browser takes the latest entry off of the history stack, fires a pop state event, and through the state parameter of this event args here, gives you that object that you passed in the first parameter to push state, which you then use to restore that page to the state that was represented by that object that you pushed onto the history stack. So, a few lines of code here, literally just a few lines of code, and I solve a tremendous user complaint about single page apps and in general any apps that load content through AJAX. That is the history API, and I wish this had been there 10 years ago in browsers. Now, am I still debugging? Nope, so let's pop out of there. Let's go back to the slides and look at the next feature. So, it's interesting. One of my favorite features or APIs in HTML is the geolocation API, which simply put lets you build location-aware apps. Now, every mobile operating system today has a location API. iOS has it, Android has it, Windows Phone has it. That allows me to build apps like Urban Spoon, which find out where the user currently is so that I could perhaps recommend restaurants and other things in the user's vicinity. APIs like this also allow us to build real-time navigational apps to get callbacks each time the user's position has changed so that we can provide an app that shows where they are and moves with them as they drive down the freeway or they walk down the sidewalk or something like that. Now, this API, too, I give an A- because, number one, it's a relatively well-designed API. It's widely implemented in browsers today, so any HTML5 browser implements this API. And it actually does a very nice job of giving you the data, the latitudes and longitudes that you want, without making you worry about details. The data can actually come from several different sources, from GPS, which is the most accurate, to Wi-Fi positioning, to cell tower triangulation. The API doesn't tell you where the data came from, although you can infer that in some cases. It gives you some control over where you want it to come from. The only reason I give it an A- and not an A, maybe even an A+, is there is one thing I wish this API let me do that it does not. When you look at the location APIs in mobile operating systems like Windows Phone exposes a property named movement threshold. So that if you're asking this API to call you back each time the user moves, you can specify how far the user has to move before a callback comes. HTML5 does not give you that level of control. If you tell it to notify you each time the user's position is changed, you basically just have to trust the browser to judge the distance. So one browser may notify you every time the user moves a couple of meters, another may only notify you after the user has moved 10. I would like to have more control, in part because on a mobile device, that could help me to be more battery efficient. Other than that minor nit, however, this is a very good API. Now let's see here. I haven't tried this since I arrived here in The Hague, so I can't guarantee this is going to work, but we're going to try it and see just how good this thing is. I'm going to run a little page named maplocation.html. Here's what it's going to do when it starts up. It is going to first instantiate a Bing Maps object so that it can show me where I currently am on a map. And by the way, see this right here? You know why I put this in there? Because I trust you. In order to use a Bing map, you have to go out to the Bing Maps website and sign up with your email address. It's free and it's fast. And they send you an API key that you have to use in every app that uses your Bing map. Now, presumably, they can use that to see if someone's abusing the service. I've actually had people in Bing tell me that they've never shut anyone down. But I included my personal API key in here, so that you can take this home, you can run it on your device, and it will work. But please, 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 if you're going to build your own app that uses Bing Maps, please use a different API key so that if you get shut down, I don't get shut down too, okay? So I create a Bing map, and then I use the location API to find the user's current position. This method is the core of this API. It accepts three parameters, two of which I'm using. The first is a success callback. This is an asynchronous method, by the way. It returns immediately. If the browser succeeds in figuring out where I am, then my success callback is called, and I'm given information like the current latitude and longitude. Now, depending on where the data is coming from, more information may be available. If it's coming from GPS, for example, you can actually get the altitude and a few other things. But at the very least, if the browser can figure this out, you'll get at least a latitude and a longitude. If for some reason the browser cannot figure out where you are, that is, it has no GPS receiver available or can't get a GPS satellite lock, you're not currently connected to a network, so it can't use Wi-Fi positioning, and it's not a mobile device with a cellular radio in it, so it can't triangulate off of cell towers, then the browser will call your error callback. There's one other time, common time, when it will call that as well. No browser in the world today will divulge a user's location without first prompting the user to do that. If the user answers no when prompted, then the browser will call your error callback and pass in a special value telling, telling you, I could tell you where you are, but I can't do that because the user said no. Now, in this case, I'm running this on my laptop. It has no GPS receiver on it and no cell connection. So if the browser is able to determine where I am, it could only be coming from Wi-Fi positioning. Now, if you've never encountered that, there's several big companies in the world, including Microsoft and Google, who maintain proprietary Wi-Fi positioning services. Wi-Fi positioning is the art of turning an IP address, the IP address of the router perhaps that I'm connected to here, into a latitude and a longitude. Now you may wonder, how could that possibly work? You would be amazed at some of the clever things that Microsoft and Google do. I'm not going to say a lot about that because I'm not sure I'm allowed to, but you will be amazed sometimes at how accurate it is. In fact, if you didn't know better, you may think Microsoft watches everything I do. They know every move I make. And of course they do, but I'm not supposed to say that. So we're going to run this here in IE, and we're going to see, does IE know where we are? Well, there's the Bing map, and there's the prompt from IE saying, are you okay with me letting this app know where you are? I'll say yes. And you may have to help me out here. We'll see how close it gets to the World Forum here in The Hague. Usually doesn't take this long to come back. Let's make sure I still have an internet connection. It has gone up and down on me a time or two today. Taking a long time to come back. Let's refresh it. I guess it was just waiting. Okay, you know what? That's not that accurate, is it? Yeah. I have no idea. Is that someplace in Thailand? I don't know where that is. So it's funny. When I did this in Belgium the other day, it got to within a few feet of where we were. Okay, so how close is it? A mile or two? Excuse me, a kilometer or two? 6 miles? Okay, well, here's the deal. Wi-Fi positioning is usually, not always, by the way, usually more accurate than this. But you know what? Maybe I try a different browser. Now, I haven't tried this either. I don't know how it's going to work, but remember, when you use this API in IE, it is calling home to Microsoft back in Redmond and using Microsoft's Wi-Fi positioning service. But if I ran the same thing in Chrome, it's going to call back to Google's Wi-Fi positioning services. I may get a very different answer. Now, this is going to be embarrassing if Chrome gets us closer. In fact, if Chrome gets us closer, you may want to enjoy this presentation because it may be my last here at Tech Days. But let's see here. Okay. All right. I hope that's way off. I have no idea where it's at. Let's see if we zoom out a bit. Okay. Is it? It's not close, is it? It is way closer? Okay. So now I want to erase your memories. You did not see that demo there, okay? But you do see an important point here. Without a GPS receiver, which of course you're going to have on a mobile device, you really can't guarantee the accuracy. But with Wi-Fi positioning in particular, you will get different results from different browsers because different browsers rely on different Wi-Fi positioning services. Okay. Location API? I didn't mention any location API whatsoever. Let's move to something that's not going to get me into trouble here. How about everyone's favorite API? in HTML5, the audio and video API. And I say everyone's favorite, being a little bit facetious. It's kind of interesting. If you go to an HTML5 party Saturday night and you walk up to people there and say, tell me, what's the one feature of HTML5 that you know about? Most people are going to say, audio and video. I've heard that HTML5 has native support for audio and video. And that is true. Now, these are kind of boring, so I'm not going to demo them, but I will tell you this. I give them a B minus, and I was tempted to give them a C. It is true that we have native support now for audio and video in a browser. We have a video element and an audio element. So, to a large extent, we no longer need plugins like Flash and Silverlight to show our video content or play our audio content. But these features are far from perfect, unfortunately. For one thing, you might think that if a committee were going to design a standard video element for every supported browser, they might settle on a common set of video codecs, a common video file format that every browser could play. Well, that was the intention, but it didn't work out that way. For various reasons, in part because this is a committee-driven platform, they could not agree on a video file format, nor could they agree on one audio file format. And there were good reasons for this. It wasn't just companies and individuals being selfish. There were companies at the table like Microsoft and Apple, for example, who really wanted HTML5 browsers to provide native support for MP4 video. Why? Because for one thing, MP4 video, you can go out on the market and you can buy inexpensive chips to put in a device to decode that video and take the load off the CPU. Plus, MP4 uses codecs that are not free. Companies like Microsoft and Google and Apple pay lots and lots and lots of money for the right to include support for those file formats and the codecs inside them in their products and operating systems. But you had other browser vendors like Mozilla and Opera who, you know, aren't sitting on $40 or $50 billion in cash, and they said, we can't support MP4 because we simply can't afford to. So the way it turned out is, you have to encode a video at least twice in two different formats, same with an audio file, in order to ensure that every HTML5 browser will play them. That's the big reason that I downgraded this feature. There are some other reasons, too, and the reasons why I considered making it a C. It is true that HTML5 has native support for audio and video, but some of the things that we sometimes need when we use media of that type are not supported here. For example, there is no DRM support, no good way to protect the digital content that you expose to a user this way. Now, that's going to change over time. There's a committee looking at that, looking into it now. It's very possible we'll have DRM support soon. There's no support for adaptive streaming or even for real-time streaming. But in the 80% case, 80% of the time, this feature is good enough that it eliminates the need for plugins like Silverlight and Flash. So I won't take the time to do a demo so that I can spend time on others, but that is my take on audio and video. Now, I'll say that this is everyone's favorite HTML5 feature, and I'm not being a bit facetious. It's one of my favorites. It is the Canvas API. Arguably the most important API that the HTML5 committees have come up with. For years and years, there was no standard way to draw into a browser window from JavaScript. Now, sure, some browsers had native support for things like SVG, which is very, very cool in its own right. But part of the thrust behind HTML5 and the motivation was to make sure that in JavaScript, we could draw things on the client side. Now, think about this. In the past, if we wanted to present a web page to a user with perhaps some test data, we might fire a call off up to a server, which would consult the database to get the data. Then we would probably generate an image on the server and download it to the browser. That worked fine. It increased the load on our servers, but it also meant it was really hard to make that image interactive, to allow the user to click a slice of a pie or a bar in a bar chart or something like that. One of the beautiful things about the Canvas API is since we can now draw into that browser window pixel by pixel if we want, we can now go to the server with a little AJAX call, bring back a little JSON maybe with the data or a little XML if you prefer, and we can do the rendering of the data completely on the client side. And while we're at it, we can make that interactive. We can now recognize when a mouse over occurs, for example, over one of those bars or the slices of the pie to make that web page come alive. Now, I gave this one a pretty good grade because, in general, it is a good API. I downgraded it slightly, but only slightly, because if you're a graphics guru, the first time you look at this API, you'll think, whoa, this is kind of primitive. Yeah, this would have been big news 20 years ago, but is this really a modern graphics API? Well, it's not. When I think of modern graphics APIs, I think about things like Direct3D, XNA, OpenGL, and others. Those are very sophisticated graphics APIs. Canvas is two-dimensional only. It's rather rudimentary in some respects. If you don't know what you're doing, you can get into issues with it on performance. But you know what? At the end of the day, it's better than anything we've ever had before, because before we had nothing when it came to making this work in every browser. So overall, this is an awesome addition to the HTML5 family. It's something that is widely supported by HTML5 browsers today, and something that if you're doing HTML5 development, there's a pretty good chance you're going to find a use for. Now, I have many, many Canvas examples that I carry along with me. I'm going to show you just a few of those. In case you've never seen it before, or in case you have seen it and you want to see some more advanced uses, here's a page I call chart.html that demonstrates how to do charting and graphing and things like that using the Canvas API. This is not an image coming from the server, nor am I going to the server to get data. I've just hard-coded the data in, but I'm literally drawing every label, every rectangle, every line, everything else, even the drop shadows that you see behind the title of the chart using the Canvas API. If you've never seen the API before, let me show you real quickly what it takes to do that kind of thing, and it's not much. Here in chart.html, if you look at the DOM, I've declared a canvas element down here. You can declare any number of canvas elements in a web page. Each one literally provides you a canvas upon which to draw. Unlike XAML, which actually lets you draw outside of a canvas, HTML5 does not. If you dimension that canvas, as I've done here, you are not allowed to draw even a single pixel outside of the canvas. But remember, you can have multiple canvases, and I'll show you an example that does that in just a moment. By the way, a couple little tips learned from the School of Hard Knocks. Always, always close a canvas element with an explicit closing tag. It is illegal to do it, to close it using the shorthand form. It'll actually work most of the time, but it will fail at random times and usually at the worst times when you're in front of your biggest and most important customer. Also, never use CSS to dimension an HTML5 canvas. If you want to set the size on that canvas to restrict its size, use explicit width and height attributes. Again, you'll sometimes get away with it if you don't, but other times you'll find things you draw on that canvas are wildly distorted for no apparent reason. That's probably because you've tried to dimension it with CSS instead of these explicit attributes. This works. Now, let me show you the code to do the drawing. So, in an app that uses the canvas, you begin your drawing by getting a reference to the canvas element itself. Then you call a method named getContext. That returns an object of type canvasRenderingContext2D, which we generally refer to simply as a rendering context or a context. And it is that object that has the methods and properties that actually make up the Canvas API. There are about 20 methods hanging off of that rendering context for drawing strings of text, for drawing paths, for drawing rectangles and things like that. And there are roughly an equal number of properties that control the visual attributes of what it is you're drawing. As a real simple example, if you look down here, here's where I'm drawing those red vertical bars in the bar chart. Inside this for loop, I'm calling fill rect repeatedly on that rendering context. That's what's filling those rectangles. And because I set the rendering context fill style property to red, this can be any valid CSS color identifier, by the way. Those bars are filled with red. Had I set that to yellow, then you would have seen yellow bars instead. I won't take the time to go through all of this. Remember, you can download the code and look at it yourself. But I wanted to show you this as a basic intro to Canvas and also to show one of the most common use cases to do charting and graphing and other things on the client side. But there's a lot more we can do with Canvas. Take a look at this little app right here. This page has not one canvas, but 11 of them. In fact, the puzzle pieces that you see here can be clicked to slide them around like that. What I've done here is actually quite simple. I've declared 11 canvases, each measuring 150 pixels square, each serving as one piece of this movable puzzle. I've used the Canvas API to take a larger image, the one of this mountain background you see, and cut it up, drawing a portion of the image onto each of those canvases. Then I've used jQuery to wire up a click handler to those canvases, and I've used jQuery's animation engine to animate the movement of the pieces when the piece or the canvas that's clicked is adjacent to the empty square. In other words, between the Canvas API and jQuery, there is astonishingly little code in this app, as you can see if you look inside it. Just real quickly here in puzzle.html, here are those 11 canvases, one for each puzzle piece. I'm using CSS absolute positioning to position them so that they have that grid-like layout. But most of the work is taking place up here. When this page loads up into the browser, I first new up an image, load the larger image that I'm going to cut up into smaller pieces, wait for the browser to tell me that the image is loaded, and then in this loop here, using the Canvas rendering context 2D's draw image method, this is where I'm cutting the image up and drawing pieces of it onto the different canvases. I then ask jQuery to find all of those canvases for me, to wire a click handler to each so this code executes when a click occurs, and you can see here that when I decide to move a piece, I'm using jQuery's animate method with relative values here to make the movement occur. Again, 30 lines of code probably, and I get something like that. Just try doing this in a 5-year-old browser. You're going to find it difficult, if not impossible, to do. There are lots of other things you can do with canvases as well. Let me show you this one right here. Actually, I'll save that one for the next session or next demo. Let me show you this one right here. I call layerdemo.html. I originally built this because I've been asked on more than one occasion by HTML5 devs whether canvases support layering or not. Well, technically, canvases don't support layering, but that doesn't mean that you can't do it anyway. This page is kind of interesting. There are two images and one canvas at work here. First, furthest away from the user's eye, that is lowest in the Z order, there is an image of the skyline with the mountain background that you see there. In front of that image, I've used CSS absolute positioning to position a canvas which is closer to the user's eye. And on this canvas, I'm animating these rectangles, partially transparent rectangles, moving back and forth to make them look like spotlights. Then in front of the canvas, I've put yet another image. That image contains only the skyline. All the background pixels have been trimmed out and converted into transparent pixels. So what would have been a very complex task otherwise, if I were to try to create a clipping outline that exactly matches that skyline, you can imagine how difficult that would be, and would probably be pretty slow as well. I'm letting the browser do the heavy lifting in doing that clipping, and if the browser wants to employ the GPU to do that, then it's free to do that. It doesn't mean the browser will, but it means the browser has the option. So I could go on and on about Canvas. I won't do that because I want to get to a bunch of other stuff as well. But realize that although it is a relatively simple API, there is a lot of richness in it and a lot of advanced techniques you can employ to make magical things happen in a web page. By the way, to do those animations there, I'm basically just running a JavaScript timer. And I'm taking advantage of something called the transform. If you are a XAML developer or used to be a XAML developer, you've probably used transforms before. Rotate transforms for rotating things about an axis, scale transforms for making them larger and smaller, translate transforms for moving them. The Canvas API supports transforms almost exactly like XAML. So these rectangles, these spotlights I'm moving back and forth, what I'm doing is changing the angle of a rotate transform each time that timer ticks, and I get this relatively smooth animation that you see right here. So there are some very, very, very cool things that you can do with Canvas. I'll stop there. I'm actually going to say a little bit more about Canvas in a moment, but if you've never seen Canvas before, hopefully that gives you an idea of what it is and what it does, and also hopefully it helps explain why I give it a relatively high grade. And I'll give you a hint, which you can see right here. I'm not going to give everything a really high grade. I'm a tough grader. My wife is a retired school teacher. She knows how to make kids squirm. And she makes me squirm sometimes. I learn from the best. What about web workers? Now, here's a feature that a lot of devs haven't heard of, and yet it is one of the most interesting and arguably compelling features of HTML5 there is. Let me tell you what this does. This feature, this specification, allows us to write multi-threaded JavaScript code. Now, let me ask you this. Did you ever think you would live to see the day that it was possible to write multi-threaded JavaScript code? Is it really a good idea? Is it a little bit scary to think about JavaScript developers? Not that they're not good developers, but, you know, in general, they are, they tend to be self-taught more often than a C-sharp developer, probably work in a less structured environment. Yeah, there's some great JavaScript developers out there, but you know what? Writing multi-threaded, highly concurrent code is the hardest thing a C-sharp or C++ developer will ever do. And if you've ever done it, you know exactly what I mean. It is the hardest thing you will ever try to do. It's not that it's hard to create threads. It's not. It's easy. In fact, anybody can create a thread. You know, boom, create thread in window, and I have a thread. I can put that in a for loop, and I can bring that entire machine to a crawl. What's hard is synchronizing those threads, right? When two threads are going to access the same piece of data, the same data structure, for example, that is a no-no. So we have to recognize when they might do that, and we have to use thread synchronization objects like semaphores, mutexes, locks, monitors, critical sections, you name it, to make sure that access to that resource is serialized. That's why multi-threaded programming is hard. And that's why this scared me a bit when I first learned about it, because you may be the best JavaScript developer in the world, but if that's all you've ever written in, you don't have a clue about writing concurrent code. So let me ask you this. It is absolutely true that this allows us to write multi-threaded JavaScript code, but what if some very smart people on the committee who came up with this feature figured out a way to give us all the benefits of multi-threading with none of the drawbacks? What if they gave us a model that was so simple you couldn't screw it up if you tried? Would you feel better about it then? Because that's exactly what they have done with Web Workers. Web Workers is the name of the feature, the name of the spec. It's also the euphemism we use for a background thread in an HTML5 JavaScript app. I give this thing an A because I think they were incredibly clever with what they did. In fact, I can't think of anything they could have done better to really deliver to us the benefits while we're removing virtually all of the drawbacks. Now, let me take you in to an app and show you multi-threading at work in JavaScript. And while I bring this thing up, I want to say a word about why this would even be interesting. Why do you need multi-threading in JavaScript? Well, there are actually two very, very good reasons that you might need it. Not that every app's going to need it, but a lot of apps will. Reason number one, it has always been a no-no, no matter what programming language you're writing in, to execute long-running loops on the UI thread. If you do that, you prevent the browser or whoever is your host from executing code that pulls messages through the message queue in response to them, and the whole UI freezes up. The number one reason that this is an interesting feature is if we have long-running computational work we want to do, we can now relegate it to a background thread that is a web worker and let it do its thing without impacting the UI thread and therefore without impacting the responsiveness of the application. But there's another reason as well. This little Windows phone I carry here in my pocket has a dual-core processor in it. You can buy phones with quad-core processors now. Almost every device has multiple cores in the CPUs, and as we go forward into the future, that's going to be more and more true. There's only one way to leverage multiple cores in the software you write, and that is to write multi-threaded software so that you can have different things going on in different cores on that CPU at the same time. Before Web Workers came along, it was impossible for a JavaScript developer to leverage multiple cores. Now, a JavaScript developer can if he or she will take the time to learn about Web Workers. Now, let me show you an example of these at work. They're relatively new. There aren't a lot of real examples of these things out there in the wild. Most of the examples you can find are kind of trivial, like they're counting prime numbers and stuff. I wanted to write something that was real, that did some heavy lifting, and that might be more representative of how developers would use this feature in the real world. And I came up with this. And by the way, it's actually going to perform better in Chrome, so since all they can do is kick me out anyway, I'm going to run it in Chrome. How about that? But IE10 does support Web Workers and supports them very well. So this little page here is named multi-mandelbrot.html. What I'm doing is I'm using the Canvas API to draw the Mandelbrot set, the world's most famous fractal. This is quite CPU intensive because what I'm doing is when the page first starts up and if the user clicks to zoom in, I'm recomputing every pixel in that scene, a million or two pixels at the resolution I'm running. And each pixel computation requires me to go through a loop with a bunch of floating point math up to 128 times. It is very CPU intensive. Now, you may not have noticed, so I'm going to do this again. Watch when I click. If you're careful, you'll see that this scene is actually being painted in fourths, one quadrant at a time. Watch as I click. And as I click again, here's what I've done. I'm doing none of these heavy-duty pixel computations on the UI thread. Instead, I'm relegating that work to background threads, and I'm creating four of them, at least four web workers. There's not necessarily, by the way, a one-to-one correspondence between a web worker and a physical thread. Ultimately, the browser relies on the operating system's built-in thread pooling algorithms to decide what the right number of threads is. But I have created four workers, meaning up to four physical threads will be created in the process, and I'm letting each worker do the pixel computations for one quarter of the display. That's all going on in the background. Because I'm doing that on four workers, and because that could mean there are up to four physical threads in the process doing that, if I'm running on a four-core device, this thing's going to run four times faster because I'm doing those computations in parallel. Now, let me show you a bit about what the code looks like here. One of the most important things you'll ever learn about is messaging between threads in an HTML5 Web Workers app. And before I show you the code, let me explain that a bit more. You may wonder, how did they structure this API to give us all the benefits but none of the drawbacks of threading? Well, number one, they made it impossible for two threads to share data. Now think about that. Those of you that have done deep multi-threading work before, if two threads cannot possibly share data, it makes it almost totally eliminates the need for threads to be synchronized with one another. And that's what they've done. It turns out that normally when you execute JavaScript code, it executes in a very well-defined context. There's a window object, for example. You can call window.alert and pop up an alert box for the user. There's a document object that lets you query the DOM and update the UI. But a web worker runs in a very special context that's unlike anything you've ever seen before in JavaScript. In a web worker, there is no window object. You can't call window.alert to pop up an alert box. There is no document object. You can't get a reference to a DOM element to update the UI. Web workers cannot touch the UI. And because there is no window object, they cannot share variables. Any var you declare or any unvarred variable that you declare is not attached to the window object. So there's literally no way for these threads to share data. Now, there's no need for thread synchronization primitives either. And suddenly, multi-threading gets 1,000 times simpler. But wait a minute. Am I not doing UI updates here from these background threads? No. It turns out, when a thread creates another thread in JavaScript, it can use a method named postMessage to post a message to the thread. The thread can also call postMessage to postMessage data back to the thread that created it. So what I'm doing is creating four empty bitmaps, each representing one quadrant of the display, newing up four workers, passing an empty bitmap to each, letting it do all the computations to fill the bitmap with pixels, then I'm post-messaging that completed bitmap back to the UI thread, which is then using the Canvas API to paint that bitmap into the proper quadrant on the screen. That's the grand scheme of things. Let me show you real quickly what it looks like in code, because if you go away from this session with nothing else, I want you to understand web workers and understand just how powerful they can be. Real quickly here. If you look inside this app here, let's go find it. It's called multimandelbrot.html. Then you go down here, and here's where I'm creating the four web workers, the four background threads, if you will. You do it simply by newing up a worker object. You pass in the URL of the JavaScript file containing the code that these things are going to execute. Now, you may wonder, do I have to pass in a JavaScript file URL? Nominally, yeah. There are some hacks that work in some browsers but not others that let you form in-memory JavaScript files. In the future, they may work in more browsers, but for today, the only way to get this to work everywhere is to factor the code that's going to execute on the background thread out into a separate JS file so you can pass the URL to the worker. By the way, the browser does the same thing here. It does with a script element in an HTML page. If that JS file has not been downloaded before, the browser will download it, but then it will cache it. So if it has been downloaded before, it will pull it right out of the cache and you won't pay a price in terms of an additional HTTP download. I then wire up a handler for message events firing from each of the workers. When a worker calls post message to post a message back to the thread that created it, that will surface as a message event in the creating thread. So that I can respond when the workers pass these completed bitmaps back to me, I have to know when they post message me. I'm doing that right here. Then, let's see, I skipped over this part. Here's where I'm creating the four empty bitmaps. In Canvas parlance, we don't call them bitmaps, we call them image data objects, but most of us would refer to them as bitmaps. And here, I'm post-messaging down to my workers, passing them information they need about what they're to do, including the empty bitmap representing their quadrant of the display. And then guess what? I do nothing else in the UI thread. I just sit back waiting for those post-message calls to come. I take the completed bitmap passed me by the worker, and I call this Canvas API method to paint that bitmap onto the screen. The real heavy lifting is done in the file that I'm executing on the background thread, Mandelbrot.js, and you can see here where it is doing the floating point pixel computations, and at the end, post-messaging back to the thread that created it with the completed bitmap. This is good stuff right here. A great model, again, one that gives us the benefits of multi-threading without forcing us to become experts in multi-threading as platforms like .NET force us to do. Okay, so out of curiosity, if you were going to give a thumbs up or a thumbs down on that feature, which would it be, thumbs up or thumbs down? All right, I see lots of thumbs up. That's a good thing. In fact, I'll put two thumbs up on that one. How about that? Just like I voted twice in the last presidential election, just to make sure my vote stuck. All right? I'm just kidding, of course. I say that and it gets into the, it reaches the wrong ears. I'll have a nice little present from Homeland Security waiting for me when I get home. Just like, by the way, did you know, this is kind of hard to believe, but did you know, the jet fuel that we run in these RC jet engines is the same jet fuel that is used in big commercial jets. In America, it's frowned upon if you walk up to an airport with a 5-gallon container and ask to buy jet fuel. In fact, you end up on terrorism watch lists, and I know because I've tried it. So I've learned to make jet fuel. It's actually easy to make. I thought about putting a slide together. If you're interested, shoot me an email sometime, and I'll tell you how to make jet fuel. One word of warning, it's smelly. Now, I happen to love the smell. My wife hates it. When I mix it up in our basement, if I spill some, the house smells like it for a couple of weeks, she gets very mad. But she's also very tolerant because she knows how much it means to me. How much do I like the smell of jet fuel? I would rather smell a cup of jet fuel in the morning than a cup of coffee. How about that? In fact, as a prank sometimes, my wife gives out little perfume bottles to her friends with jet fuel in them. She says, you know, if you and your husband are going to have a romantic evening and you want to get him jazzed up, dab a little of this back here, and oh boy, no man can turn that down. Now, how about another feature, web storage, maybe another of the most important features, which I give a B instead of an A. Now, let me tell you real quickly what web storage is. In the old days, HTML and JavaScript didn't really give us a way to store data persistently on the client side. Suppose you had a simple need, like first time a user visits your website, you want to ask them for a language preference, and then you want to store that so that you don't have to ask them again and again every time they return. In the old days, you might have stored the data in a cookie, but there are lots of reasons we don't like cookies, right? They're limited to how much data they can store, which is a good thing because they travel up and down the wire, polluting requests and responses. They're not secure because anybody can see them on the wire unless the traffic is encrypted and so forth and so on. If HTML5 is going to be considered a real application platform, it must give us a way to store data on the client side that persists beyond the lifetime of the browser session. Rather than give us direct access to the file system, the HTML5 gods came up with web storage. Now, there are actually two types of web storage. There's local storage and session storage. Session storage is interesting sometimes, but it tends to be less interesting because it lasts only as long as the browser session lasts. That is, when the browser is closed, you lose what you've written into session storage. It's still useful for sharing data between pages, but when most of us think about web storage, or when you hear about it at parties on Saturday nights, in most cases, they're talking about local storage, which persists theoretically indefinitely. So, If you want to store stuff persistently, maybe the level that a user achieved in a game, or maybe you're building a United States tax form website where a user can come and input all their tax data. Good luck with that. That's going to take about 6 years to fill all that out. But you want to be able to save the data in the interim in case they go away and have lunch or shut their browser down or something before they finish the form. Well, you could store it all in local storage. So it's a good thing. In fact, it's vital. But here's why I give it a B. There's some very, very frustrating limitations. Number one, it's not really for structured data storage. Local storage is exposed to you, the developer, essentially as a collection, as a dictionary of key value pairs. You can write any type of data into it, but the data is stringified, and it's not coerced back into its original type when you bring it out. So you write a number into it, you read it back out, you get a string, you have to call parseInt or something like that. Of course, what most of us do, we just use JSON.parse and JSON.stringify to JSON encode everything. Since it's going to be stringified anyway, that makes serialization and deserialization really easy. But that's not what really frustrates developers. What frustrates them is quotas. Because it's scary to think of a JavaScript app being able to write unlimited amounts of data to any persistent store, since ultimately, on a desktop browser, that data is going to be written out to secret places on the hard disk. The web storage specification recommends, and browser vendors have followed up with this recommendation, that we limit how much data an app can write. And generally, it's 5 megabytes. It varies some in browsers, different browsers, but 5 megabytes is a good rule of thumb. It may not sound too bad. You may think, well, you know what? My app can probably live with 5 megabytes, but here's the big problem, folks. Unlike mobile operating systems, which assign every application an app ID that is unique in the universe and which then scopes data written by that app to that app, there's no such thing as an app ID. There's actually no formal definition of an app in HTML5. So virtually all scoping in terms of security and storage in HTML5 is done based on the concept of something called origin, which is a combination of protocol, host, and port. In other words, an app, an HTML5 app that lives at www.microsoft.com lives at a different origin than one that lives at www.apple.com. And in HTML5, it is basically impossible for those two apps to know about each other or to access data that either has written to local storage. But here at www.microsoft.com, there may be thousands of apps that use HTML5 web storage. The problem is this quota is a per origin quota. It's not that any one app at microsoft.com can write up to 5 megabytes of data into local storage on a given PC for a given user. It's that all the apps combined at Microsoft.com can't write more than 5 megabytes. If you work in a small organization, a small company, this probably doesn't affect you much. It affects big companies in a big, big way. And there's not a great solution to it today, to be honest. Here's what I do. There's a little method named Clear. You can call on window.localstorage to wipe out everything everyone else that your company has written to local storage. One other reason, by the way, I downgrade this API just a bit. There is no API in it for determining how much storage quota you have remaining. Every byte, literally every byte that you write into local storage, if you've properly structured your code, has to be inside a try-catch block, so that if an exception is thrown telling you you've exceeded your quota, you'll catch that exception. That's where I call localstorage.clear, by the way. But aside from that, it is an API that we value in HTML5 because without it, or before it, without resorting to browser-specific APIs, we really didn't have any options. Let me show you one quick example with local storage here in case you've never seen it. I'm going to run a little page named storage-scribble.html. And here's what it lets me do. First, close your eyes real quick. Okay, hopefully you didn't see that. So I see a blank chalkboard here, and I'm using the Canvas API here to let the user scribble onto the chalkboard like that, or they can double-click to erase it. So let's scribble something on there. I'm going to close this browser down. Normally now, that data would have been lost, but as you can probably guess, I'm writing these XY coordinate pairs defining the strokes that the user has drawn into local storage. And each time the app starts up, I reach into local storage, and if I find those XY coordinate pairs there, that's my bad there, let's go back and select this, then I recreate what the user drew the last time. Now, because I'm writing this into local storage, it is being persisted in a secret location on the hard disk, and it doesn't matter if I shut the browser down, shut my machine down, this data will still be there the next time, just as if you had written it to a file in the file system. Now, a couple of other things, and on balance, this is a really good feature, don't get me wrong, but remember that you are limited in how much data you can write, and it's not something you control because there are going to be other devs in your organization probably who are writing and deploying HTML5 apps as well, and you may have no control over them. Also, realize that while the web storage specification tells the browser vendor what the API should look like, it doesn't tell the browser vendor how or where to store the data, which means in no way can local storage data written from IE be read from Chrome. And this is a big deal sometimes. You know, you're building an app, you want it to work in any browser, and if you have users that sometimes use different browsers on different days or something, they're going to run into this. They use IE one day, use Chrome the next day, and they think everything that they saved in IE is gone because Chrome can't pick it up. Also, don't ever assume that what you write into local storage is secure. IE actually hides it away, but in Chrome, once you know a couple of keystrokes, you can see everything that has been written into local storage. So if you made the mistake of writing something in there that was sensitive, well, you know, bad guy might be able to see it. So, web storage is both good and bad. It's good because it at least gives us a way to persist data on the client side. But, you know, with these frustrating size limitations and all, it is a source of frustration. Enter IndexedDB, one of the latest and greatest additions to the HTML5 family of features. Now, there's a bit of history here. The original intention was for HTML5 to support a client-side database, just like many mobile operating systems do. In fact, there is still to this day on the W3C's website a specification called WebSQL Database. You can do a search on it and you'll find it, but when you find it, you'll see there's a big red box at the top of the page that says, do not use, this specification is officially deprecated or abandoned or something like that. You see, it turns out that, again, this is something being written by committee. There are many, many different dialects of the SQL query language out there in the world today. The members of this committee could not agree on which dialect to use, so the entire effort to include a client-side database in HTML5 died. And for a while, it looked like we were going to have, you know, no recourse. Then some smart folks got together and said, this is silly. We've got to have something. So they came up with IndexedDB. Now, there's both good and bad here, which is why I gave it a B. It is a fairly recent, recently added feature. You can see you don't have widespread browser support yet. It actually supported very well in IE10 and in recent builds of Chrome. That's where I do most of my testing. Number one, it allows you to store structured data, almost like a database, but not quite. Number two, it does give you an escape clause past the quota limitation. What most browser vendors are doing is giving you a default quota, but allowing that to be raised with the user's permission or raised through policy, Windows policy, for example. So in IE, for example, each origin's given 10 megabytes of storage, but if you try to write something into an IndexedDB that contains more, instead of just saying no, IE pops up a little prompt to the user saying, hey, this app needs more storage for IndexedDB. Will you allow it? If the user says yes, well, you could theoretically get access to all the storage that you wanted. There's another downside, though, as well, that really bothers me. While it is a database in that it lets you have multiple entities inside it, think about a relational database, which has multiple tables, each of which has a schema consisting of multiple columns. This is an object database. It doesn't have tables, it does have object stores. And yes, you can have multiple object stores, each of which stores an object, but there is no schema. This is JavaScript, after all. You can plug anything you want in any of those tables, and there are no schema violations or anything else. You can index the tables, that's good. So if you have an object store that has hundreds of thousands of objects in it, you can imagine if that were just local storage, it could be very, very slow to iterate through all the objects, finding the one you want. You can index these object stores the same way you index tables in a relational database and do very, very, very fast retrievals of the data. But here's the thing that just kills me, and it made me almost want to give this an F, but I didn't, because this specification is still changing on an almost weekly basis. There's a huge, huge problem right now that will be fixed. actually a two-pronged problem. Number one, there's virtually no query language here. There is no SQL query language, period. I can live with that. I understand why. But the big thing, everything is case sensitive. What little querying capability they give you is totally and utterly case sensitive, and there's no option for turning that off. If you go out to the discussion forums and you look at what developers are having to do, it's ridiculous. To do non-case sensitive queries, they're maintaining shadow copies of every object store in which all the text is uppercased, just so they can do a query. To me, if the committee doesn't fix that, then this is an epic fail. But since this feature is relatively new and still being developed, I believe they will fix it. That's why I didn't mark them down some more. Now, let me show you here real quick. We have about 10 minutes left, if my watch is correct. That's good. Good enough to fit in lots more stuff here. Let me show you one of the few examples, working examples of this in the world. And by the way, this code breaks every time a new build of Chrome comes out, or every time a new Windows Service Pack comes out, it seems. So this may work today, but if you download these samples and try them a month from now and it breaks, well, it's because the spec changed, not because of my code. So here's what I've got. That's it. Blame it on somebody else, right? So, long story short, we RC jet pilots maintain logs of our flights just like full-scale pilots do, and not just because we want to be cool like the full-scale guys, because we save time and money by doing it. It turns out there are certain parameters that you can get from a jet engine after a flight that, if you track over time, help you recognize trouble, perhaps catastrophic trouble, as it develops and before it becomes catastrophic. For example, if you see the maximum exhaust gas temperature of the engine going up over time, probably means deformation of the combustion chamber or in the injector needles. Good time to send that thing back to the manufacturer and have it overhauled. Another common problem is if you track max fuel pump voltage over time, if you're developing a clog in the fuel system somewhere, and these things use fairly small fuel lines, typically 4 to 6 millimeters, you'll see the pump voltage going up over time because that pump's having to work harder to pump the jet fuel past the clog. If you track this and you know what's happening, you can go in and inspect that fuel system, take it apart, clean it out or whatever before you have a dead stick in the air. The last thing you want to do with one of these RC jets is have the engine quit up in the air. So we track these things. I do it on a Windows Phone app, but I'm over time building an HTML5 app to do it. This is sort of an early prototype, and it does use IndexedDB. I won't take the time to go through the code so I can get to some other things, but I will tell you this. If you look at the code, you'll see all the essentials of working with the IndexedDB API. There's one object store. Each record is an object describing one flight of a jet. You'll see how I do a query to get all the objects from a table. I'm also doing this. I'm doing the equivalent of a SQL select distinct to find out which different jets are represented, and I'm dynamically creating these HTML buttons at the top. And when you click one of them, it does some filtering by re-querying the IndexedDB to show only the flights pertaining to that jet. By the way, I didn't mention this, but this is a fully transacted database. So not only can you have multiple object stores, you can do operations that span multiple object stores. And if one of those operations go wrong, you can roll back all of them, just like in classic transactional databases. So there is quite a lot of power here. It's one of those features that's probably a little early to use in a production app, but keep your eye on it, because it's only going to get better and better and better. Now, let me skip right on to here. There are actually, I'm going to make this really quick. No, I'm going to go straight to here because this is more important. So real quickly on file APIs, notice this big mark down here. Short story is this. If HTML is going to be a serious application platform, we have to have a way to access files on the hard disk. There is a specification in the HTML5 family called the file API, which defines an object called file reader, which does let us read the contents of files from the hard disk. Never, by the way, without the user's involvement. The user has to offer me the file, either through an open file dialog or through a drag and drop operation. It is impossible, and probably will be for many, many decades, to write an HTML5 app that, say, goes out and enumerates all the files in your My Pictures folder and shows thumbnails. That is simply not permitted. So that's the good news. The file API, which is really a file reader API, believe it or not, however, back when they first defined or started working on that API, apparently they didn't consider the fact that we might need to be able to write to files on a hard disk as well. That is actually impossible today. I've got an app that I would show you if I had more time. It's kind of Photoshop in a browser written in HTML5, lets you do image editing. I'm using the Canvas API. I'm using the File API to load images from the hard disk. But one reason I'm not going to show it is that I have no way in an HTML5 app of saving the edited bitmap back to a file on the hard disk. Now, I can do it with browser-specific APIs. There is help on the horizon in the form of two absolutely recent additions to the family, the File System API and the File Writer API. Only one browser implements those today, Chrome, and it doesn't map what you do in that API to the physical file system. It maps it to a virtual file system, but at some point, some browser vendor is going to get brave, and they're going to map these APIs in their browser to the physical file system, and then finally, we will be able to write to the file system from an HTML5 app, but today we can't do that, therefore, a big fat D. Last two things here. I've saved a couple of the best things for last. XML HTTP request level 2 is perhaps one of the most important features of HTML5. It is AJAX version 2. AJAX has been around since 1999. A lot of folks don't know who invented it. Microsoft invented it. Did you know that? Microsoft invented AJAX. But we're the company that doesn't innovate, right? Yeah. So, yeah, we invented AJAX. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Now, despite that, there are a lot of things that are very limiting about AJAX. Many things. Number one, I bet a lot of you are thinking this already. Why can't I go cross-domain with an AJAX call? Isn't that crazy? I can do it in C#, I can do it in Java, I can do it everywhere else in the world, but I cannot use JavaScript to make a cross-domain call because of some silly security restriction imposed on me by a browser vendor. Guess what? That's fixed in XML HTTP request level 2. It does require that the server essentially provide permission for a cross-domain request to take place using a new, well-designed, relatively simple, header-based protocol called CORS, C-O-R-S. That's short for cross-origin resource sharing. There aren't many publicly available servers in the world that will take a cross-domain AJAX call, so I built one. It's a WCF service running on the server back home, and I can show you an actual, honest-to-goodness cross-domain XML HTTP request or AJAX call taking place. Here's what this thing looks like. It lets me enter a US zip code like home of the mothership, Redmond, Washington. Looks like it's currently 40 degrees there, not too bad. Let's see where I go home tomorrow. I live in 37934. Supposed to be pretty warm tomorrow, considering, well, that's pretty cold. It's going to have to hurry to get warm before I get home tomorrow night. So anyway, I am calling out to a server running on a remote domain back in the US directly with AJAX, no bridging out to local web services, pedal to the metal, straight cross-domain call. AJAX level 2 makes that easy to do, and the code for it could not be simpler. Just real quickly here, if you look at this, it's basically the AJAX you know and love with a cleaned up API and the now with the freedom for you to provide an absolute URL rather than just a relative URL as the target for that AJAX request. By the way, they fixed a lot of other things with AJAX as well. Devs get frustrated sometimes because AJAX doesn't contain native support for timeouts, because if you're using it for file uploads, it's difficult to provide a progress display to the user. So they've added progress events. They've done almost everything you could possibly ask for. But let me close out with this feature right here. It's something called WebSockets. And some people would tell you that it may be the most important feature of HTML5. Indeed, it may be the most important thing to happen to networking in the last 10 years. This feature is so useful and so relevant and so cool that support for it is now expanding out of HTML5 into other platforms like .NET 4.5 and Windows 8, which build in very, very good WebSocket support. What is a WebSocket, real quickly? HTTP has been around for ages. HTTP is a pull protocol. We call a web server, we call it with an HTTP request, we can input data, and we can get data back in an HTTP response. But what if you want to build a real-time app in which the web server can push data down to the client? Maybe you're showing stock prices to the user, and you want that display to remain fresh, and you don't want to have to constantly poll the server. We've always had to resort to hacks like polling, HTTP long polling comet and things like that. With WebSockets, we finally have a protocol that allows a web browser and a web server to establish using an HTTP handshake, which is friendly to firewalls and friendly to proxy servers sitting between the two, a two-way duplex TCP connection so the two can communicate passing data back and forth anytime. This is how you build chat apps in HTML5. I recently heard of, and I don't think I can say anything about who's doing it, of a real-time Skype-type app built entirely in HTML5 that is going to be on the market soon. This is a pretty amazing thing. If you've never seen it at work, let me show you one quick demo here. So what I'm going to do is go back to Visual Studio, and I'm going to run a page which I call WebSocket Scribble right here. In fact, I like it so much, I'm going to run two instances of the page, and the other instance, just to be contrary, I'm going to run it in Chrome. And the reason I'm doing this is, while HTML5 gives you precious, precious few ways to actually let browsers communicate, if you go through a WebSocket server, they can communicate all day long. So I draw in one of these. Everything I draw is transmitted over to the other. It's a two-way protocol. I won't have time to go through the code, but let me tell you what you'll see if you look at the samples. Number one, the HTML5 client. You'll see me newing up a WebSocket object. Very, very simple API. You'll see me registering a handler for the message events that it fires. That event fires in my code whenever a message is pushed down from the WebSocket server. And when the user finishes drawing a stroke, you'll see me calling a WebSocket method named send, which transmits data up to the WebSocket server I'm connected to. Very simple API, easy to learn, easy to wrap your head around. Then, in case you're interested as well, .NET 4.5 has terrific support in the form of a new namespace named system.networking.websockets system.networking.sockets, come to think of it, for building WebSocket servers, which has never been easy in Microsoft land. There in that project, I've got the source code for an ASP.NET WebSocket server using .NET 4.5. Basically, each of these clients, when it starts up, establishes a connection to the WebSocket server. Every time a stroke is drawn, it fires that stroke off to the WebSocket server. The WebSocket server then enumerates all the connections that it's holding and shoots that stroke data, which is JSON encoded, out to all the clients except the one that transmitted it this stroke to begin with. So yes, you can build real-time apps now like this. One last thought regarding that. Whenever you hold a connection open for a long time between a WebSocket server and a web client, you lose some of the scalability of HTTP. So realize, if you're going to build something big and massive that's going to serve hundreds of thousands of WebSocket clients at the same time, you will need a large and expensive server farm to do that. So with that, I'm going to say goodbye. I hope it's been a great conference for all of you. Again, feel free to download my samples. Digest them, use them, share them with colleagues, do whatever you want. If you find any bugs in there, I hate to say it, they're my fault, but if you do, let me know about it so I can fix them for the next time. Thank you for coming to Tech Days, and I hope to see you again next year.